That's South Africa's legendary Winston Mankunku Ngozi on tenor sax with The Birds. It's from his award-winning 1968 album, Yakal Inkomo, and you're hearing the strains, of course, of John Coltrane, who Ngozi said greatly influenced his work and his style. Coltrane died a year earlier. Ngozi, one of the pioneers of modern jazz in the African continent and in South Africa in particular, died in 2009 at the age of 66. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today a program that will begin a series of programs we'll be doing on major cop cases, cop killers, and we'll be taking a look at the legal prosecutions of these cases in today's program and also in the next few days. A year ago, as we said last week, we had the indictment in Chicago of police officer Jason Van Dyke in the first-degree murder of Laquan McDonald, who was 17 years old. This occurred in October of last year. The officer is returning to court today to find out whether he will actually get bail. Over the weekend, protests in Chicago ramped up, again calling for justice. And this is why we are beginning today to talk about these cases and to talk about the double standard of justice that seems to favor rogue cops when these cases are prosecuted, if at all they are prosecuted. Let's take a look, listen, at the protest, which drew the participation of the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Congressman Bobby Rush, who happens to represent one of the most populous congressional districts in the nation, that's Chicago's South Side. Here's what they had to say. We will also hear from Charlene Carruthers, the national director of the Black Youth Project 100, one of several grassroots groups that had organized the protest.
Position in our urban areas, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We've abandoned urban policy, drugs in, guns in, jobs out, and there is no substantial urban policy deal with violence and reinvestment and reconstruction. In this case, while Laguan has captured our attention, 450 have been killed in Chicago, 450 killed this year, 2,700 shot. 75% of those persons have not been captured who did the killing. So we've got to restock the murdering. There has been a rush these last few days to bring about some relief. But I submit those who saw the tape and held it up for 13 months must be made accountable. The police chief saw it, no doubt, and sat on it. And the nine police who were his accomplices who saw it did not recommend he be fired. And the state's attorney all need to go.
Thank you, Reverend. Congressman Rush, you can make changes, but what should happen now?
Well, we're going to keep marching. We're going to keep protesting. We're going to keep marching until we get it right. We haven't just started this. 45 years ago, we were in the same position with the murder of Fred Hampton and Marvin Clark. 46 years later, here we are again, police brutality. We want the state's attorney gone. We want to convene a new grand jury, a grand jury. We want the police indicted, an independent prosecutor. We want all of these things. Our fight for justice will not stop. These young people are taking the lead right now.
And I don't want to stop because as a young person, how do you feel to see all this happen?
So my name is Charlene Carruthers. I'm the national director of the Black Youth Project 100. Young black people from various organizations are calling on the police to be defunded. We live in a city where the Chicago Police Department takes up 40% of our city's budget, while just a few years ago, we closed over 50 schools. What signal does that send about the value of the lives of young black people when we don't have a school to go to? We need immediate firing, a resignation of Anita Alvarez. We need Mayor Rahm Emanuel to resign. We need Superintendent McCarthy to resign, and not to be in a system where cops who kill our people not only take our lives, they take our money, and they do not invest in our future.
Well, all three views are quite relevant, but I do make the following observations. We have the old guard and the new. Reverend Jesse Jackson and Congressman Rush representing the old guard. They had done their time. They had contributed to the advancement of civil rights causes, one more radically than the other. Reverend Jackson chose the moderate path with Dr. Martin Luther King and the peace movement and the established civil rights movement as we know it. And Bobby Rush, coming out of the Black Panther Party, we had a more radical view, a more radical approach to black empowerment and black power in the United States. So it was interesting to see them together in this march. I have noted many times about the evolution of Jesse Jackson. At one point, was himself a candidate for president under the Rainbow Coalition, and transmuting all of that support, taking all of that groundswell of grassroots support for his candidacy, hijacking the Rainbow Coalition for his own purposes and his own uses, and taking all of that as personal currency to shore up his currency with the Democratic Party. And we have the vibrant sound of Charlene Carruthers representing the new generation, people who have had it with this gradualist approach to change and who are taking on the burden, taking on the challenge, and the scary prospects that they confront in the course of protesting and advocating for change. I think protest is not only necessary, it is appropriate, and it is way beyond time that the community become agitated, not just over police killings, but about the general state of affairs. But I would say that one of the things that is missing in this equation, because they have come up with an approach, the approach also starting in Chicago this weekend, was to refrain from spending any money at all this holiday season, to just keep your money in your pockets. And if you must spend, to spend consciously and conscientiously, supporting local businesses, support the community. And that's a great thing. It's a wonderful awakening. And it's a wonderful method of raising community consciousness. I think one of the most important ingredients in this groundswell of protest and uprising is missing. And that is punishment. Absolute punishment. Principally of the Democratic Party, of the political system generally, but specifically for the Democratic Party, it must be punished. Why? Because all these things have multiplied under Democrats. And in Chicago, where they're fighting, nobody knows that better than Jesse Jackson. His brother, Rahm Emanuel, who used to be chief of staff for Bill Clinton, is now the lord of the city with rogue cops, and which he seems dedicated to protecting. This is for the creatures were more than willing to meet with Donald Trump. The black preachers who tell people about the civil rights struggle and blah, 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 blah. This is a time for them to stand up and say, this year, this election year, no vote. Do not vote. We are not voting. Create absolutely refuse the vote, because the vote means nothing. And these incidents only underscore the point that people invest their power in a system bent on keeping them powerless. You have nothing to lose. Do not vote. And that should be a campaign. Destroy the Democratic Party. I know it sounds really horrible to say, but I think it's the perfect thing to do. Destroy it. Disable it by withdrawing your support. And see how quickly things change. Destroy that and put something in its place that serves your specific needs. You have given them the benefit of time. You have given the system the benefit of doubt. And they fail spectacularly on both grounds. This is a time to courage, and the leadership courage, they would stand up and say, we will not participate in the charade. Gee, you fought so right to vote. But they don't complete the thought. The right to vote for something meaningful, the right to vote for the right for your interests. That completes the thought. So in as much as this remains the objective conditions of life for most African Americans, drastic action, there is no more strategic way to exercise that, along with economic, very strategic use of your dollars and cents to punish the system. You punish it. You absolutely bring the Democratic Party to its knees. This is the party of the slavocracy of the South that continues to keep the bulk of African Americans, Black America, and Latino America in servitude, in bondage, by their political shenanigans and by their intent. And this is just an expression, the business of these cops, the rogue cops that are protected by the system. And here we have people who are supposed to be powerful. What is the word that they use? We want. We want this, and we want that, and we want the other. You're begging. You have power, and you're begging. There's something wrong with that. Forget what you want. You don't go asking when you have this much power and leverage, and you're still talking about what you want, implying that the system has the prerogative and the option to give it to you or not. And you're waiting for an answer and hoping that the answer is, we'll give it to you. Though you know, statistically, you're not going to get it. When you understand that you have power and you can leverage that power in your interests, then it is incumbent upon you to act like you understand what you're doing. And that's why I say any person with courage today, in a capacity of leadership, there's only one thing that they should extol and propagate, and that is the utter and complete destruction of the Democratic Party. And something new, support something new that speaks to the interests that this party for centuries has ignored. Now, let's see if anybody has the guts to do that. Let's see if any Jesse Jacksons will come forward and say that. They won't say it. Instead, they will tell people, come out and vote. Bring your souls to the polls. And, of course, the Democratic polls. Go ahead and put them in so they can continue the sad and sorry legacy of white supremacist political oppression. Let's see who has the courage to do that. We'll take this break, and when we come back, we'll go to the city of Baltimore, where trial begins today of the six officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on BRN.FM. I'm Patrice Lead. Jury selection begins today in the city of Baltimore, in fact, in Baltimore City Circuit Court, in the trial of Officer William Porter. He's the first of six officers charged, Freddie Gray, 26, who died on April the 19th, a week after suffering traumatic being to a station house in a police van. We have the extraordinary luck and the extraordinary gift of our guest, Attorney at War, Alton Maddox, Jr. He's also called the People's Attorney General, and for good reason. He has litigated several precedent-setting police brutality cases in New York. He has advised on other cases outside of New York. And he's here today to discuss the prosecution of Porter and of Gray's other alleged killers. And this is going to be the first of a series of very close looks that we'll be taking at major cases that are now coming to the court, ostensibly for prosecution and ostensibly to deliver justice. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today. Well, the trial begins. The jury selection starts today. Two of about eight jurors in the city of Baltimore, and a couple of questions. One, let's start with the first question. Would be a legitimate claim that no matter who the jurors end up being, the police officers are likely not to get a fair trial because the jury pool has been influenced by media coverage and is therefore biased?
Well, I think the reality is that the police officers as defendants are being given preferential treatment. And not only in terms of the bail that was set in a case of this magnitude, but also in the sense that these police officers have had the ability to have a judge pre-selected who has a similar prosecutorial background, which may be a benefit to the police officers. and they have been given an opportunity to, among other things, not have to attend court as most defendants have to do. And so when you consider the various preferential treatments that have been accorded to these cops, it's hard for me to then come back and argue that we are dealing with a level playing field. And two, if we are not playing with a level playing field, how much of a head start does the police officers have on the rest of the criminal justice system, which may enable them to beat the criminal justice system to the final line in this case. And so, you know, that would be the way that I would have to view all of this. And then considering the fact that you have the juror of commissioners who is able to pick and choose without any oversight from the community, because the community has failed to consider that this is actually a class action and that the community should be involved in every phase of this criminal prosecution, it's very difficult for me to believe that the juror of commissioners will pick a panel that he believes would be favorable to the prosecution in this case in terms of a conviction. So I think when you add all of this up, the forecast would have to be innocence of these or not guilty of these defendants, especially when you consider the fact that the lead defendant is not the lead defendant. And that is something I said from the beginning. They were very curious to me how William Porter would become the lead defendant when he had very little to do with the death of Freddie Gray. He was not the supervising officer. He was not the other two officers who actually apprehended Freddie Gray. And I think that it would be very difficult for a jury to give all of these different variables to return with a guilty verdict against Porter. And this, in turn, will have a domino effect on the rest of the defendants in the case.
Well, you anticipated my question, actually, because I was going to ask you about the fact that Porter was not the officer with the most serious charges. So, in your view, how did he end up with being the first officer to be tried? Is this kind of a trial balloon in a way that the prosecutor is using to figure out whether with leading off with Porter and building up to the other officers is the better way to go?
Well, I think really the reality, and this is something that I had said right after they were charged with these crimes, that is the police officers, I said then that there should be a motion to intervene on behalf of the community to be involved in every aspect of this case and to have legal counsel who would refute most of what the prosecution was doing. And this is very much similar to the approach that was taken in the murder of Michael Stewart here in New York City by several transit officers who basically was ticked off or irate over his kissing a white woman near a subway, and she was apparently headed out of Manhattan into Brooklyn. And so you had a case of Michael Stewart having to pay a price for that. And, you know, and then Louis Clayton Jones, Michael Warren, and myself, I think pretty much establishing that way, in that case, the model approach of the community in fighting the prosecutor line by line and step by step, which in that case did force eventually the prosecutor to have to make these police officers stand trial. And so I think that when a prosecutor's office look at the facts, they are able to reshuffle the deck and come out with a decision that is most favorable to the police officer. And I think that's what they did here. They looked at the deck of cards and they reshuffled them. And it came out with a shuffle that indicated that William Porter would be the lead defendant, which normally means that he should be the architect in that particular case, and he's not the architect.
Well, from your perspective, as the case begins, besides the fact that the question that you raise about the jury pool, there's a question you raise about whether Porter should, in fact, in the first officer, based on the severity of charges against him as well as the officers, whether it was to have him be the lead defendant in this case. What other concerns do you have from the trial experience that bother you about this case?
Well, you know, as I said before, I think the case starts really what happens at the outset, you know, and I find that basically, you know, when you're in a situation where you can pretty much pre-select the jury and then turn around and make opening statements, that pretty much seals the fate of the defendants in the case. And that is basically what I'm saying here, is that this decision has already been predetermined, including the only rational decision that the jury itself can return based upon the cause that they have been dealt with. And so, you know, I've always said that any trial is won or lost before the jury hears any evidence and after the jury has been impaneled. And coupled with the quote opening statements that are made by the parties. And so, you know, I suppose my point is that I think the decision that will acquit these defendants has already been made. You know, and so, I mean, that's just the way I tried all cases myself. Now, I don't know what, you know, I mean, the other issues that, you know, may come and get involved, things like the medical examiner's findings, the expert testimony relating to a cause of death and those things. I mean, from my point of view, I think they've already been settled. But for those people who don't necessarily agree with my approach, you know, they may feel as though the scientific evidence in this case might be very critical. And I suppose some people may think, even though I think the experience demonstrates otherwise, that the fact that the family here took hush money, you know, may hurt the particular case. So all of that, you know, is already out there on the table. And so I don't know how much more you can do to reshuffle the deck in order to bring about the guilty verdict.
Well, the prosecutor here, Marilyn Mosley, nonetheless is proceeding with this case, but has she inadvertently, has the city inadvertently provided the defendant in this case with ammunition for their defense? I mean, when the city pretty much has moved toward settlement, the obvious defense would be, well, gee, the city already expressed a bias in this case and has already tried our clients and determined them to be guilty. Otherwise, they would come to any settlement. So the trial that is a kind of double jeopardy in a way.
Well, that seems to be the irrational argument, but, you know, what I have found in experience, in cases where there had been some type of settlement like this before the jury has a chance to deliberate, is that in real life, you know, a lot of times the jury take a position where they've already gotten their justice. And, you know, so, you know, even though they have lost a son family member. But let's not forget they have $6.3 or $4 million now to play with, and we don't want to go overboard and be too excessive. Now, that's the way I have seen it. But on the other hand, one could argue that, you know, it's just quite the reverse. But I just haven't seen that in reality. You know, I think that any time you take hush money and, you know, be able to either say that you want to exonerate the city and all of that, I think that becomes also another mission that works against the family or the community, as one would argue that the way that the city did it may subject these police officers to double jeopardy. And so, therefore, you have a washout between those two different claims.
Officer Goodson is charged with second-degree depraved heart murder. It's the most serious charge among the six officers. He's also charged with manslaughter, second-degree assault, two acts of vehicular manslaughter, and conduct in office. What about these charges do you think is going to be the hardest to prove? And do you think that, in fact, I remember when Ms. Mosby announced these charges, immediately there was a human cry that the officers as a whole, but particularly Wilson, was overcharged. Do you think this would come back by the prosecution in this case as to whether the jury would be so inundated with different charges that they have to determine that they basically may just avoid the whole thing altogether and give the benefit of the doubt to some of the defendants?
Well, you know, the thing about it is that when you talk about Goodson, you're talking about somebody who's just simply a van driver. And, you know, yet you have the supervising officer who was very much involved in the actual arrest of Freddie Gray. And his involvement also sent out to two other police officers who were white in order to bring Freddie Gray back to the scene. And given all of that, I mean, the way that most people think is that the person who's the supervising officer must bear the most responsibility in the case. I mean, this is like the Nuremberg prosecution where, you know, you really start out with the proposition that those who are at the top must suffer the consequences of the actions of those done at the bottom.
So if you're defending, let's say, if you're defending Goodson, if you were defending any of the officers, including William Porter and Lieutenant Rice and Sergeant Alicia White, all of whom face involuntary manslaughter, second-degree assault and misconduct in office charges, officers Edward Burrow and Garrett Miller charged with second-degree assault and misconduct in office, what would be your position? I mean, how would you disarm the prosecution in this case?
Well, my position would probably be in that scenario to point a finger at the supervising officer, I believe Lieutenant Rice, and I would actually put him on trial. You know, if that was an opportunity I had, I think somebody have to be put on trial. And I think in this case, it has to be Rice. And if the prosecution refused to put him on trial, I think somebody else does have to do it. And in prosecuting Rice, I think they invariably exonerate your client.
So that at some point, when the defense begins, that this is exactly what they're going to do, they're going to be arguing that, in fact, the prosecution basically overcharged, and now they try to make the case post facto after they have already cooperated, I guess, with the city and made a deal, the family, to pay the settlement.
Right. You know, the key thing, you know, that becomes impossible is that if you can attack the credibility of the prosecutor and the prosecution teams, you've actually gone a long way in getting your client free from these criminal charges, because even the prosecutor and the prosecutor's team have some credibility concerns, and if those credibility concerns are such that the jury will simply just not believe the prosecutor because of credibility, then you pretty much have gone a long way in winning the case. I mean, this is why many times you put the prosecutor or you put the government on trial itself, because it's a two-in-one in the sense that you now have destroyed the credibility of the prosecutor, and therefore you have destroyed the theory of the prosecution.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask about the issue that you raised before, and that is that there ought to have been, or there still should be, and that's the question, should there still be intervention by some other independent entity as having an interest in the case on a class basis, a class action basis, and how is that done? What is the benefit of such an intervention?
Well, I think the benefit is something I'll discuss, but I will start out by saying that, you know, one thing that you have to do in law is not go along with the way that you have been defined by the adversary or by the judicial system. So, you know, the first thing you want to do is to change the alignment of the definitions. And so in changing the alignment of the definitions, you want to be able to argue, for example, that a criminal prosecution is actually a class action, and that it is brought on behalf of specific people, those who are similarly situated. And in a case like this, more particularly, you're talking about a class of descendants of enslaved Africans that should be given the preferential treatment in the way that it is pursued. Then secondly, what you want to do is to redefine yourself, and that you're not just a defense attorney, but you are actually a people's attorney general. And in addition to that, you're also a person who has a real interest in representing the class that is there. And in that sense, you know, your argument is that, you know, it's the people who actually have the interest in the prosecution and not necessarily the state, and that, you know, the idea of the state just automatically being given the right to represent descendants of enslaved Africans is not the appropriate way of dealing with things. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when I saw these kinds of cases, the first thing I did realize you had to reshuffle the deck, and then you have to make sure you're not dealing with a local elected a prosecutor, but you are dealing with a special prosecutor who afterwards will have to be subject to the bargaining that you impose on that special prosecutor. What people saw in, for example, Howard Beach and Tawana Brawley in those cases was a governor appointing special prosecutor. But what they didn't see was that the special prosecutor had to sit down and negotiate with the persons who were representing the family. And so in the case of Charles Hines, for example, Mr. Hines and I actually sat down and we discussed exactly what we thought would be the best approach to sustaining convictions in Howard Beach. And it was only after those negotiations were settled and agreed upon did Mr. Hines take that script and decided, you know, that he was going to prosecute and convict based on that script. Now, when we got to Tawana Brawley, again, there was negotiations. But this time, Abram and I were unable to reach an agreement on the script. And on top of that, he was also an elected official and not a special prosecutor. And he did not in any way want to be seen as anything but an elected official. And so, therefore, the negotiations broke down. And then you started having people make the argument, well, Tawana won't cooperate. But those people were totally unenlightened, had no idea what was going on. And therefore, you know, you ended up in a stalemate. Of course, you know, people also don't realize that Tawana Brawley could not have ever been charged with anything in this case because New York never had jurisdiction over the case. She was never served with summons and complaint. And more importantly, as a minor, no guardian ad litem was ever appointed on her behalf. And so, you know, that's the other part of it. And then when you look at that, in my estimation, you know, what you're really talking about is actually having an actual historian who records everything that goes on in the case so that, you know, later on in life, one can look back at it and examine the various entries that were made in that particular case to determine what really occurred. And it's because too many times things are happening in such a breathtaking manner that people don't have time to reflect until later. And then when they reflect later, they realize that it wasn't as the way the media was reporting it. But I think those are the things that are, you know, really important, that you have to deal with a class action, and you have to deal with the people who are more directly affected by the action that had been taken that had caused the death, for example, of a particular defendant. And so when you go back to the case in Maryland, what you realize is that if the family had really not bought the bite and said that instead we're going to initiate a class action and we're going to have everybody involved, it wouldn't take long before you start bankrupting these cities because now you're talking about paying out a lot more money than $6 million because you're talking about doing other things that would be necessary to bring this case to a screeching halt. And so in matters like the ones that we've experienced in New York, where you have on one hand a case where somebody gets a substantial amount of money, and then to be followed by Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell and all of those cases, well, you realize that it's not enough being done to actually punish the city and to encourage the city to take actions that will prevent this kind of conduct in the future. And so that's a matter of planning, and that kind of planning we are not doing right now. And so, you know, we have all these cases, you know, coming up with $5 million here, $6 million there, $7 million there, but the shooting just continues because it's not enough money put on the table to deter anybody from committing those acts in the future. And more importantly, because there's no punishment, this kind of conduct will continue because there is no deterrent effect to the action that people are taking.
This country that you're describing, has it been tried before? I know you referenced the way in which you did it, and I remember that because of the Howard Beach case in particular, and the Brawley case in which you played a critical role in influencing how the prosecution approached these cases and even the investigation of these cases. Is there any in the U.S. where in any jurisdiction this strategy has been employed and with some degree of success?
Well, yes, and that really happened right here in New York City because in 1984, Bernard Goetz got on a subway and shot up four young black men. And then 2 years later, you had the case of Howard Beach. And then the next year, you had the case of Tawana Brawley. And so what happened was is that as I looked at those cases, I realized that those cases should not be classified by their individual names, but actually classified under the rubric of white vigilantism, and then go after white vigilantism. And in doing that, what happened was you had the convictions in Howard Beach, then you had Tawana Brawley, but and that was intercepted by what happened with Yusuf Hawkins, where Joseph Farmer got 33 years. And right after that, that became the end of white vigilantism. I mean, because by that time, people had noticed what happened in Howard Beach. They noticed the 33 years to life that Joseph Farmer got. And so the streets became safer. You know, Dinkins talked about safe streets, safe cities, but he wasn't the one who made the streets safe. You know, and I think a lot of people got to go back and reexamine who actually made the streets safe, at least for white vigilantes. Now, you know, but at the same time, Utrice, it's very interesting that 5 days after Joseph Farmer received 33 years to life, that I was immediately barred from practicing law in New York. So, you know, and people haven't examined that to recognize that New York State was never in accord with bringing these white vigilantisms to a halt. And instead, you know, just like people in the South, they were very comfortable with the Ku Klux Klan continuing to terrorize black people.
As the case progresses, again, jury selection begins today, what are some of the markers that you will be looking at to actually will shape up the actual prosecution?
Well, some of the markers right now is certainly in terms of actual jury selection itself, in terms of the way that jurors are selected, because, you know, usually you have cases like Bassin versus Kentucky, which is a leading case in terms of arbitrary selection of jurors. And so, you know, I would want to be particularly interested in that. I would be interested in what happens if, for example, it is determined that no fair-minded jury can be chosen in Baltimore County. You know, and then what the defendants might do in terms of asking for a bench trial and maybe getting a bench trial as really what they were seeking in the first place, but they needed this cover of a jury selection in order to protect them in what may be the ultimate goal in this case, and that is letting these cases be tried by judges instead of jurors.
Well, I do know that, I mean, that's always been the option for a bench trial because we have had the reality of judge shopping where such cases end up before friendly judges who just dispense with the cases and find that the defendants are not guilty. This happened in the Amadou Diallo case, as a matter of fact, if I recall.
Well, it should have been Sean Bell's case. That's correct.
Yes, yes. From the prosecutor's point of view, how do you think it's shaping up? Do you think that this prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, has what it takes to take on six police officers who are fully supported by the Fraternal Order of Police and other enforcement organizations? And, of course, coming up against the old rubric of she would not be the first, does not want to be the first to lose this kind of a case, but has not really cleared, she's really highly thought of at the moment within the law enforcement community.
Well, you know, I think the thing that's important here is that although Marilyn Mosby has been able to engage in a preemptive strike a few months ago, that in the moment brought her early applause from the black community, the reality is that she is still a prosecutor, and she still has to work with the police, and they are still arresting blacks in Baltimore in wholesale numbers. And in order for her to do her job eventually, she's going to have to work with the police. And that's the reason why, in cases like this, she shouldn't be ever put in a position to be where she is now, even though up until this moment she has been able to skillfully camouflage the fact that she is, in reality, another prosecutor.
Well, thank you so much, Alton Maddox, for being with us today. And, of course, we'll continue the discussion tomorrow on other police cases. And we'll take a look at the legal ramifications of these cases through your guidance. And I thank you for being with us today. Thanks so much.
And thank you for the invitation again, Eutrice.
Oh, you're welcome. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it made you think about something, about these cases, and about the swelling of opposition against these cases and the actions of police, rogue cops in these cities, and killing off people with apparent impunity. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour, and you can reach me at leadsstreet.com. I'll be glad to hear from you. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.